Hi, Judge Eden. This is Casey. I just wanted to know that all the parties are on the line. Would you like me to proceed with calling the case?
Yes, please.
The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Richard K. Eden presiding over docket number 20-00102, Zhejiang Yunying Standard Park Company LTV and Ningbo Zhangjiang High Strength Bolts Company LTV versus United States and Vulcan Threaded Products Incorporated. Counsel, when I call your name, please introduce yourself to the court. Gregory Menegas?
Hello, Your Honor. Thank you for having this argument today. I represent plaintiff Zhejiang Shenyue and from the law firm of DeKeefer, Horrigan.
Okay.
Alexandra Salzman?
Hello, this is Alexandra Salzman from DeKeefer and Horrigan, also representing the plaintiff.
And who is going to make the argument today?
I will, Ms. Salzman.
I'm sorry?
I will. This is Alexandra Salzman. I'll be making the argument on behalf of the plaintiff.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
Kavita Mohan?
Anyone else?
Yes, good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is Kavita Mohan, and I am from Grunfeld Desiderio, representing plaintiff intervener Ningbo Zhongzhong High Strength Bulls Company Limited.
Okay. And
Ashley Akers?
Hello, Your Honor. This is Ashley Akers from the Department of Justice representing the United States.
Okay. And do you have someone from the Department of Commerce with you?
Yes, I'm here. Good afternoon, Your Honor. This is Jesus Sainz from the Department of Commerce on behalf of the defendant of the United States.
Okay. And anyone from the defendant intervener?
Yes, Your Honor. Good afternoon. This is William Fennell representing Vulcan Threaded Products at the law firm of Shagrin Associates.
Okay. Ms. Salzman, you represent the plaintiff, so why don't you tell us what your complaint is?
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Alexandra Salzman again on behalf of plaintiffs. We thank the court for granting plaintiff's motion for argument in this case. From previous cases, we know the court is very familiar with the Export Buyers Credit Program and the department's normal defense of applying AFA in finding use by respondents. As laid out in our briefing, the court has considered the non-use of EBC program in numerous cases, and the court has consistently found the department's position was unfounded and remanded it to the department, where now the department has a practice of agreeing on remand under protest to find non-use of EBC. While the second issue of this appeal, that regarding partial AFA and plaintiff's affiliates may be unique, and we will address it, we requested this argument particularly in light of the department's approach to the EBC program generally, because despite over a dozen opinions directing the department that its AFA finding that the program is used is not supported, the department continues to make the same decision across the board in reviews and new investigations such as this one, effectively penalizing Chinese respondents, and indeed the entire Chinese industry, with this 10.54 countervailing subsidy in most every case. And in this case, that times three. So we hope through this argument, the court will see that the department has no new facts and no new reasoning in this investigation than any of the other court opinions invalidating the department's EBC finding. Accordingly, we hope the court will swiftly remand to the department to reverse its EBC decision and even caution against the department's continued finding of this of the use of the EBC in the first instance. And as this is an investigation, the results of this appeal are particularly time sensitive because they could be overtaken by the first review results. So for these reasons, we requested oral argument and we thank the court for granting this. As for the first argument, our main argument that Jinya did not benefit from the EBC program, we know the court is aware of this issue and the department's justification. The court has dealt with this issue many times. So
okay,
accordingly,
so the one different wrinkle here is the affiliates. How do they play into all of this?
Yes. Right. I mean, we know the court is very familiar with this first issue, so if you don't want to hear our argument there, we can let that rest on the briefs. We know, yourself,
okay.
Your Honor, has particularly
addressed
this in court.
So tell me about the affiliates, if you will.
Okay. So before discussing that second argument, we also want to make clear, which we did present in the briefing, that our understanding that if the court holds the EBC program applied to Jinya is unlawful, consistent with the numerous past cases that we cited. We understand that the attribution of the EBC to the affiliate should also be considered unlawful because in the decision memo, the department itself, and I quote, found that as partial AFA, Commerce finds that affiliates A and B also benefit from all of the state programs. Jinya benefited from, and the subsidies they received attributable to Jinya are in the same subsidy rate. I missed a word in there. This is at page 47 of the IDM, where the department's sole basis for applying the EBC rate to the affiliates was an inference of Jinya's own benefit. So before I dive into the merits of this argument, but we first find that if the court properly finds that Jinya itself did not benefit from the EBC program, then according to the department's own reasoning, it can't be applied to the affiliates because it was only inferred by Jinya's own use. So if the court rules, as we have argued in our brief, on this first primary issue, then it should also resolve the second issue of the affiliates.
Okay.
Moving on to the actual argument between affiliates A and B. In the final determination, Commerce found that Jinya failed to disclose the information that affiliates A and B provided certain services to Jinya. So as a result, Commerce did not have all the information to determine whether these companies were cross-owned. So as AFA, Commerce found that Jinya and affiliates A and B were cross-owned. Just for the court's background, in CBD proceedings generally, if companies are cross-owned, then the department requests subsidy information from those affiliates and attributes subsidies to the respondents. However, in this case, this cross-owned decision arose at the end of the investigation. So the department did not have information on the record and found specifically in the IDM that there's no record evidence that indicates that affiliates A and B could not have benefited from the same programs that Jinya benefited from. So the applied effect of partial AFA decision was that the department presumed that these affiliates benefited from every single subsidy program that Jinya did. However, the administrative record actually did contain evidence that these two companies could not have used one particular program, the EBC program. The EBC program provides loans or credit to qualified U.S. customers of a Chinese exporter. But the department has not disputed that these two companies do not produce or sell subject merchandise. Jinya reported as such in its questionnaire responses, and at verification, the department found no discrepancy with that issue. They only found that these companies had provided some services. So with no production
was
or
it,
exports of their
was
own,
it, they only provided services, or did they provide parts, inputs, anything, just services? What were the services?
Yes. The specifics were confidential, but the services, I could say, were I can direct you to the exact part of the verification report, but it was minor services.
It had nothing to do with physical objects?
That's correct. They did not provide an input that was used. It was a service in the production of merchandise, which is why Jinya did not believe that these companies were cross-owned or should have been considered in its questionnaire responses, since they did not produce subject merchandise and they did not provide an actual input to Jinya.
Okay.
Right. So I can direct you page 437 of the whole appendix, so like the stamped page at the top, is where the verification report is where the department specifies what these companies did.
Okay.
Actually, 435, sorry.
two pages earlier. So, yes, these companies provided a service only. So the department did not dispute that these companies didn't produce subject merchandise. So with no production, and then second point, the CBP data on the record showed no imports of subject merchandise from either of these companies. So without production or exports of their own, these companies could necessarily not have export buyers to benefit from this program. So unlike the other subsidy programs where the department presumed as partial AFA that the affiliates benefited from these programs, there is actually evidence on the record that these companies could not have benefited from an export buyers program because they did not produce and they did not export.
Okay.
So factually,
with respect to the affiliates, there are no certificates of non-use.
That's correct. But the certificates of non-use, I mean, it would have been relevant to customers, and they had no customers.
Okay.
I mean, they didn't produce the subject merchandise. They didn't produce the subject merchandise or sell the subject merchandise. And that information is on the record. So we say that contradicts the department's statement that there's no evidence that these companies could not have benefited from certain programs. So that's a factual argument, but we've also made the argument of the department's application of total AFA in the past. So we cited several cases in our 56.2 brief at page 20 and our reply brief at 17-18, where Commerce applies total AFA in countervailing cases numerous times. And every time they only apply this EBC 10.54% once. They never inquire into the cross-owned companies and multiply it multiple times. Indeed, it's a uniform AFA rate in and of itself. We remind the court, 10.54 rate itself is AFA, already with deterrence built into it. So it's wholly unreasonable and contrary to these other cases where they've had AFA and only applied this once despite multiple cross-owned companies. Like here in this case, where it was only partial AFA, that they multiplied this program threefold application. So in past practice of AFA, this is contrary to that practice. The department does not have a practice of multiplying based on cross-ownership. And then the factual argument, which I presented first, that there actually is information that these affiliates could not have benefited from an export program when they had no exports and didn't produce subject merchandise. So that is our argument for the second point, which we, again, reiterate that this program should not be applied to the affiliates if the court also agrees with us on the primary argument that we most urgently care that the court pay attention to the department's continued practice with the overall EBC program, that they continually find the same reasoning that the court has invalidated over and over again, requiring plaintiffs to come again and again before the court for those same issues.
Okay. Is there anything more to your argument?
Not regarding the second point. I mean, if the court does not want to hear our overall EBC program, we leave that to your discretion. We know you're familiar with the issue. But that is the main point we wanted to draw the court's attention to, is to, you know, ask the department that there's no different arguments here. There's no different facts here. And the court should find the same way as the dozen or so other cases on the EBC program, that the only evidence there's no evidence of a gap on the record due to China's failure to cooperate, and the Commerce cannot close its eye to the evidence presented by Jinya that they do not have non-use. So we are prepared to go into those details, but we understand if the court does not want to hear the details of that argument as it's been presented many times before the court.
Okay, and even to me a few times. Okay.
Yes, even to you.
So I thank you for your argument. If there's nothing else, let's hear from the plaintiff intervener.
We support plaintiff's arguments with respect to the Export Buyers Credit Program. We incorporated their arguments by reference in our briefs, and our client also had evidence of non-use on the record in the form of customer declarations. We have nothing further to add, but I'm happy to address any questions the court might have.
Okay. How about the defendant, Ms. Akers?
Akers, thank you, Your Honor. I will just address one point as it relates to the first issue that I understand Your Honor is not wanting to hear extensive argument on, but there is one factual distinction here that I think is important to note, and that's in this case in particular, the facts here really highlight why it's so important that Commerce has an ability to verify companies like plaintiffs' statements of non-use. Here we have a question of affiliate A and B, and Commerce explains that throughout the course of the investigation, Commerce asked numerous times whether these affiliates provided any sort of inputs or were involved in certain ways with Xingya, and they provided either false or misleading or not comprehensive information. And it was only at verification did Commerce find out that the two affiliates actually did provide processing and manufacturing services. And so that it just really highlights the importance of why verification is so important. We can't take the statements from respondents at face value all the time. Commerce has a need to check the information. And so going back to this export buyer's credit program, these same parties, Xingya, also provided these declarations of non-use and now are arguing that the court should accept those at face value even though Commerce has no ability to verify them. And
well, when you say you have no ability to verify them, in one or two cases, well, it seems to me that judges have asked the, I believe, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, have asked the department to try to verify using some other method than just asking the Chinese government to explain the program. Am I right or am I wrong?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and in this case, did you try to verify the certificates of non-use?
No, Your Honor, and the reasoning is explained at length in the IDM, as Your Honor is aware, and Commerce explained that it could not verify. Page 36 of the IDM, Commerce, after almost 10 pages of explanation, concluded that absent the requested information, the GOCs and respondents' claims of non-use are not verifiable. So this case is different factually from other cases prior to Commerce having some information about the program, such as the $2 million threshold and whether third-party intermediaries were involved. Now that Commerce has some more information that it's gathered over the course of these cases, Commerce now has determined it is not possible to verify it, and Commerce laid out numerous reasons. And so in those other cases that Your Honor referenced, Commerce speculated that it would be, you know, very difficult to verify, and it probably would take a lot of resources. It probably wouldn't be fruitful. But at this point, Commerce has fully committed after analyzing this program and all of the information that it has over the course of the past years from all of these cases, that it's just not something that Commerce has the ability to do while the government of China is being non-cooperative and refusing to provide this information. And
okay, so these 10 pages are appearing in this case for the first time.
I think, Your Honor, that these 10 pages are similar to some of the cases that have been before this court in the past approximately year. But my assessment of, you know, reviewing all of these IDMs is this is either one of the most or the most comprehensive explanation as to why Commerce cannot verify based upon the government of China's refusal to cooperate with it.
Okay, so there's something new in this IDM.
I wouldn't say, Your Honor, particularly that there are new reasons. I think Commerce is really relying on some of the same rationales that it's had in the past year, year and a half, as it relates to these cases. But its explanation to the court and its ability to tie the specific information that it's requesting to the parties in this case and why it's necessary is more comprehensive than Commerce has provided in the past. And so in the past, I think Your Honor, for example, in the first Clearon case, explained that it's not enough for Commerce just to be curious about this program, right? Commerce actually has to tie what information it's seeking to the respondents and explain why this information is necessary to verify these particular non-use declarations or certifications. And in this case, Commerce did that. It explained specifically why all of the information that it requested is far beyond just an exercise in curiosity. Rather, it's the only conceivable way that Commerce can verify these statements of non-use. And it's so important that Commerce has an ability to verify non-use, especially in a case where it's found a respondent, like Jinya, was not forthcoming in other parts of the investigation, as we know from the affiliates A and B issue that's raised before this court. Although I agree with plaintiffs that it's generally the same issue, I think that Commerce's ability to gather more information and articulate better to the court why this is so important for it to have the ability to verify is really much different and much more comprehensive here than it has been in the past.
Okay.
I'll next go to the second argument with regard to the affiliates, and I have 3 points of response to the arguments that were raised just a bit ago by plaintiff's counsel. The first is that the factual argument as to whether the affiliates could or could not have benefited. And Jinya is arguing here, based on CBP data, that there's no way that these affiliates could have benefited. And unfortunately for Jinya and Commerce, really, Commerce never had a meaningful opportunity to actually make that assessment because Jinya was not forthcoming in its responses during the investigation. So it's really putting the cart before the horse to go to the merits when, in fact, Commerce had no opportunity to actually do its own investigation on the merits to begin with. Not to mention that CBP data only identifies imports of subject merchandise, and we know these affiliates don't produce subject merchandise, but they could have benefited from the program through another exporter, and that's something that Commerce would have looked at had Jinya been forthcoming to begin with and had Commerce known about the true relationship between these affiliates and Jinya. So the factual argument, it's really something I don't think the court needs to get to. It's something that Commerce didn't have the opportunity to analyze, and it really comes after we assess whether it comes after we assess whether Commerce had the ability to apply AFA because of the inability or not being forthcoming by Jinya. The second point I want to make is that plaintiffs are arguing that Commerce has a past practice of not multiplying this program. And as an initial matter, citing two cases is not sufficient to establish a past practice. There's ample precedent in this court and in the Federal Circuit that says two or three isolated instances or cases is not sufficient to establish an agency practice, and we would argue that same principle here. And second, as we explained in our brief...
And this position is one that has been taken by the Department of Justice, say, over the last 20 years. The two or three cases or two or three investigations don't establish a practice?
Yes, Your Honor. I actually just filed a motion the other day in a trade case that cited that exact principle. I'm not saying, Your Honor, that two or three instances is not – if Commerce has two or three instances and we could say, look, this is evidence of a practice, but merely citing a few isolated examples is not conclusive that the agency has this long-standing past practice of never multiplying a rate in the export buyer's credit program. That's my only point.
Okay. All right.
And then just one other point on that is the two cases that are cited include when Commerce is applying full AFA, and here it's an application of partial AFA. So even if two cases could establish a past practice, the facts are simply different here, and Commerce treats partial AFA and full AFA cases differently because it's a different application of AFA, so it wouldn't be indicative of a practice that Commerce would be held to here anyway.
Okay.
And that's all that we have, Your Honor, on the second issue.
All right. Is there anything else you'd like to bring to my attention?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you. Mr. Fennell.
Thank you, Your Honor. William Fennell for Vulcan Threaded Products. I am going to address the first issue briefly. Commerce recently sought to obtain certain information to enable verification and was denied it. Commerce did not have any obligation to look elsewhere or to come up with some other more resource-consuming method for verification. It did not have to.
So the cases that have gone before that have suggested that have remanded this issue to Commerce, directing them to come up with some method to verify these, say, the certificates of non-use, have no application here. Mr. Fennell, are you there?
Yes. You're asking me if they are relevant or not?
Yeah.
Well, I think there, again, I think the basic principle is that Commerce has it's the master of the law, and it can choose the method it seeks to verify. In fact, in this instance, Junye, if I'm pronouncing that right, suggested one as an alternative that Commerce could sample all of the different importers, all of their records. As has been, explained, Commerce has explained how much work has to be done to verify this kind of information. It limited its examination because of resource limitations to two mandatory respondents. So the suggestion is that they should go and examine, extensive amounts of documentation of a number of different importers, at least five in this case, I think the public record shows, and look at every single one of the loans that those companies might have. So that's again, in a situation where Commerce has indicated at the beginning of the investigation that it has limited resources, that is not a reasonable approach for it to take. The respondent has suggested, well, they could sample it. Well, why should they have to sample it instead of going to the source, the government of China, that can give them information that will allow them to review the loans and pinpoint the ones where they need to look at full documentation on. If they
had
that,
one reason might be that it's been the pretty consistent findings, including findings of my own in cases that have suggested that Commerce try to do something else. But apparently, those cases have no application here. That's your position?
My position is, with respect, Your Honor, is that the Commerce should not be limited by somebody else. Obviously, it has to be limited by this court. I agree with that. But its methods of verification shouldn't be developed because a particular government has stonewalled the questions it's trying to ask for the past 5 years or so, as we indicated in our exhibit.
Okay. So I understand your argument. Do you have anything else?
one more thing. Just 1 minute. I think that's it, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Ms. Salzman, a final word?
Yes, I'd like to make a couple points in rebuttal to the Department of Justice. As to the first overarching EBC issue, as Your Honor was already directing in your questioning, there is, as much as you asked, is there anything new, is there anything different in this case compared to past, and nothing of substance has been pointed to. We were also involved in the Clearon case that you recently remanded a couple months ago. The reasoning in that case is the same as the reasoning here. These detailed reasoning has been seen, and still the department.
Well, Ms. Acker seems to be telling me that the explanation in the IDM is more complete, and so
And yet does not point to anything in particular. I mean, at the same time, the same situation has happened here, that the department has not even attempted to verify non-use. And there's other non-use.
I'm going to interrupt you for just a second. Could everybody else, except for Ms. Salzman, mute their phones? Because someone is making noise, and I'm having difficulty understanding Ms. Salzman. Please go ahead.
Sorry. Yes, we would again direct the court that the criticism that this court has given the department in the past for not even attempting to verify is the same in this case. That we cited at page 8 of our reply brief, we explained how the department has verified other non-use and for other loan cases by looking at the books and records and determining, and yet continues to find over and over again that it can't even attempt to verify in this case. As this court is aware and as we've quoted, even when applying AFA to a non-cooperative foreign government in a CVD case, Commerce has to still look at respondents' actual reported data, the data that detracts from its decision, and attempt to verify. And again, they're not attempting to verify or explain that there's an actual gap in the record. The one item that I want to rebut that the DOJ attempted to say was connecting Genya's partial AFA decision. First, that was not in the IDM. The department did not associate Genya's partial AFA decision, which is with its determination to find EBC in the first place. And indeed, that connection would be illogical because it was only about cross-ownership. The department did not find an overarching problem with Genya's reporting. The partial AFA was only to find that these companies were cross-owned. So to suddenly undermine and assume that the other records cannot be verified, it's just not supported, and not supported by the verification report where Commerce did verify all these other information and found Genya's reporting was accurate. There can't be an overall idea that Genya's reporting can't be accurate in this case when Commerce did not attempt to verify to the contrary for this issue. And then second, to our second point,
Ms. Salzman,
about
this is Greg Menegas. Could I interrupt? I'm sorry to do this by phone. It's a bit awkward. But assuming that you're going to move on to the CBP data argument next, I just wanted to make a few points for the judge. I was one of the first private attorneys to verify EBC at a importer's offices in California in the investigation, the countervail investigation.
Is this on the record anyplace, Mr. Menegas?
Well, it's not in our briefs, but I want to make a general statement of practice, if I can just step back to a higher level. We did discuss the fine furniture case in our brief.
If this is going to be a...
I want to discuss the fine furniture decision.
Make a legal argument, if you would, please. Not an anecdotal.
Okay, the legal argument is that Commerce cannot disregard the beneficiary. Fine Furniture said, if the government didn't cooperate, we can assume something's countervailable, but if the respondent is there to cooperate and offer their data, we will still assess the calculate the margin based on the cooperating respondents' data. Here, the respondents are here and available to cooperate and have offered their data. And this is a unique program where the beneficiary is in the United States. So they obviously have to go to the United States to verify the importers. They can't necessarily verify them at the exporter's place of business. And there's a parallel in the anti-dumping law when there's a related reseller. They always go and verify their U.S.-related reseller. So this is just not difficult to do, and it's done all the time. They can't take a legal position that on this one program, we can completely ignore the beneficiary in attempting to ascertain whether a program was used. So that's okay. Really my only point on that subject.
All right. Well, thank you. Ms. Saltzman, anything else you'd like to say?
Yes. Yes, just one point as to the factual and legal argument for the affiliates and their non-production and lack of exports. You know, the record contains no evidence that these companies produced or sold. The DOJ brought up the idea that perhaps they produced some other product that they sold to the United States. However, that's not the scope of the department's inquiry for the Export Buyers Program. They asked whether customers of subject merchandise in the United States receive benefits under this program. They don't open it up to every product. They only ask for your customers that receive this product. So the scope is about this product, the subject merchandise, and the only evidence on the record is that they don't.
And the department had the opportunity to ask the affiliates these questions.
At verification, they could have made further inquiry.
They could have, but they didn't.
No. And then in the verification report, Commerce said the only discrepancy they found with our reporting of these affiliates is that they had certain services, and so they found cross-ownership as a result. But there's no questioning that they produced subject merchandise or had exports to the United States. So we would just direct the court to that fact, and also that the idea that these total AFA cases that we cited are not practiced. I mean, we cited a couple cases to establish this, and Commerce provided, or the DOJ provided no cases to the contrary. We could provide more cases. This is affirmatively a practice in total AFA cases, but they only provide this uniform 10.54 AFA, right? They don't multiply it multiple times. And indeed, the idea that the difference between a total AFA case not being relevant to a partial AFA is also nonsensical. Why would a respondent be penalized many more times in the context of a partial AFA case than a total AFA case? So I just wanted to make that point that these cases are relevant to the department's normal treatment of this case in a more advanced situation than we are here, where it's partial AFA only to cross ownership. And with that, rests our case on these facts, unless if the court has more questions on that issue.
Your Honor, this is Greg Menegas. Could I just make one last point to follow up on Ms. Saltzman said, and then we will close our case?
Okay.
We did supply several more additional cases in our reply brief, and so it's not the case that we threw out one or two cases, and as Ms. Saltzman points out, the government came back with nothing. They know this is their practice, and you can only look at this actual case to see how they handled the other respondent. In other words, the EBC is a total adverse facts decision on one program where the Commerce has taken the position that once the GOC doesn't cooperate, it doesn't matter what the cooperation level of the respondents are. And if that's their rationale, then why wouldn't they be multiplying this across all cross-owned companies in all cases? It's certainly not their practice. It wasn't their practice in this particular case. And we cited many more cases in other instances where they did not do that. It is simply not their practice. So we think it's very disingenuous for them to suggest we didn't provide authority, and they can just claim that it's a practice when they never addressed this even in the IDM. So we hope you consult the cases that we've cited in our briefs, and you could agree with us that this is not their practice. And with that, I would rest our presentation.
Okay. Anything from the plaintiff intervener?
I would just add one additional factual point, which is on the record, which is that the declarations of non-use from the customers were also supported by the GOC, which also provided these screenshots of the search results from the Ex-Im Bank credit management system database of users, that none of the U.S. customers had availed of this program. So, and that's in the record at it's PR 121 to 178 or CR 43 to 53 at pages 7 to 11 of the initial questionnaire response. So really there is no evidence of any kind of, you know, nothing on the record really supports the DOC's position. Substantial evidence on the record only points to non-use.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you all very much. Is there anything else anyone has a burning desire to say?
Your Honor, this is Ms. Akers from the Department of Justice. If I could just make perhaps one very quick point.
Okay.
The plaintiff's counsel pointed out that I didn't explain the difference between the comprehensive nature of the IDM in prior cases like Your Honor's Clearon case in this case. Obviously, Your Honor has the record of that case, and the IDM in that case that addresses the Export Buyer's Credit Program is from pages 13 to 14. Here we have 12 pages, so I don't feel the need to go through all of the more extensive analysis, but the Department of Commerce has provided far more explanation as to why it's impossible to do this verification as it stands now.
Okay. And I will hold on 1 second, please. I'll take a close look at that. Ms. Saltzman, do you have anything? You get the final word.
Oh, I wanted to clarify I was not referencing the original IDM. I was referencing the remand proceeding that you are aware of and had before you for that October Clearon court case. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Now, is there anything else that anyone would like to say? If not, thank you very much for this enlightening argument. The court's adjourned.